The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Retailer Search for Answers. Indoor malls across the Triangle and the country plan new strategies to attract shoppers as the pandemic spreads extreme caution on all fronts. And this cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, Shopping Centers Seek Shoppers, for vendors to keep afloat, for the malls to stay open, for our economy to flourish. And this is written by Connie Gentry. America's shopping malls are back in business, but the question is, for how long and how will the pandemic reshape the experience going forward? Malls are reopening across the country, but are often about half full, with parking spots available in prime locations and even the most popular stores free from long lines. On a recent sunny afternoon at Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh, there were hundreds of parking spaces available. Traffic inside was roughly half of a normal day, with cookie stores waiting for customers, escalators carrying only a passenger or two, and many stores, including Apple, closed. Even at a dominant retail center such as the streets at South Point, traffic is seeing traffic only half of normal levels. But South Point at least is positioned to survive despite the length of the pandemic. As the pandemic continues, experts are saying the demise of weaker malls will only be accelerated. Industry projections that previously said one-third of all malls would close by 2030 have been accelerated by COVID-19, and Jeff Green, a partner in the Hoffman Strategy Group, now predicts that a third of all malls will be gone by 2023, possibly by 2022. Any mall that was classified as a B or C, meaning it was struggling or ratty, will face certain death sooner rather than later, says Green, who is based in Phoenix and works with retail real estate clients around the country. While everyone agrees COVID has flipped the fast-forward switch on the inevitable demise of brands and properties that have been bordering on obsolescence, the conversation unfolding across the retail industry is increasingly about transition and reinvention in the face of ongoing uncertainties. The only thing we can be certain of is that there will be profound change, says Howard Meetner, managing director, Karl Marx Advisors, and former CEO of Sephora and the Museum Shop. One of the things that will drive this is how consumer behavior changes in light of the health crisis, as well as how new businesses have stepped up, particularly in the online side, he said. Jan Niffen, a retail industry analyst who spent 20 years in senior management at May department stores, has been sounding a similar alarm for years. As early as 2014, he said the U.S. had 300 malls too many. Since COVID, Niffen says as many as 500 of the roughly 1,000 malls in America should close, and the same dire outlook holds true for retail stores. We will see more damage faster than anticipated because the trend to online shopping will accelerate, he says, noting his earlier forecast that the industry would lose 10,000 stores a year for more than 20 years has also ramped up. I think this year we could lose 50,000 stores, and I wouldn't be stunned if we lost 100,000 stores between now and early 2021. The consensus among analysts and industry professionals is that the top-ranked malls will survive. The percentage of people shopping in the malls will fall over time, Niffen warns. But remember, there are 278 great malls, and those great malls can see rising foot traffic, rising rents, rising occupancy rates. The problem is that there are 1,000 malls, and that's too damn many. In the Triangle, Green says, the big winner here is the streets at South Point, and maybe North Hills and Raleigh. From a sales per square foot standpoint, those are the strongest centers. The people who will struggle now that have never struggled in the past is Crabtree. He cautions, noting that the mall has declined, and when North Hills was redeveloped, it really hit Crabtree. Also, digitally, native brands that are expanding into brick and mortar like Warby Parker tend to like North Hills better than enclosed regional malls. If you look at the retailers that are probably going to struggle the most, it is those national tenants like New York & Company, Express, The Children's Place. Those are the folks in Crabtree. Reinventing Crabtree. Since its inception in 1972, Crabtree Valley Mall has been one of the biggest and most successful enclosed malls in the region. In recent years, that reputation faltered as flashy competition came from North Hills and Durham, and traditional malls around the country slipped from dominant to diminished as big box anchors struggled with the online shopping surge. But two trends bode well for a Crabtree renaissance. Raleigh is a market projected to rebound strong, and new talent has taken the reins to lead the shopping center forward. Pacific Retail Capital Partners, which took over management of Crabtree on April 27, manages more than $2 billion in assets with over 12 million square feet of regional, open-air style, and mixed-use centers. Green acknowledges that Pacific Retail coming on board to manage Crabtree is a big advantage. Pacific Retail is a strong company. They're very creative, and they're accustomed to taking B malls and doing the best they can to stabilize them, Green says. Leslie Himley, Crabtree's Marketing and Business Development Director, says consumer traffic has been rising quickly since the mall reopened. Traffic jumped 41% from Saturday, May 30 to June 6. The curbside pickup program is also taking off. We have great participation. Already 20% of our tenants, 40 stores, are using the curbside program. At least 7 more tenants have said they will be using curbside when they open, Himley says. COVID was obviously the start of curbside, but a lot of our tenants want to continue with the curbside program as we go forward. The curbside approach is part of a push in retailing to be more omni-channel, that is, reach customers in a broad variety of ways. The pandemic created the opportunity for all retailers to become omni-channel, and the brands that didn't take advantage at this time are probably going to suffer, says Nadja Kayum, Senior Vice President of Marketing at Pacific Retail. There were a lot of knee-jerk reactions during this crisis to move entirely online, but what makes really good brands so great is their clarity in recognizing the wants and the needs of their specific consumers. That can include everything from offering a touchless experience to diversifying retail operations across various platforms so consumers can pick up curbside, shop in physical stores, or buy online and have it shipped. The move to omnichannel. Omnichannel has been the buzzword in commercial real estate for a while, and the pandemic has accelerated this trend. South Point, too, has seen the popularity of its curbside pickup surge. Pat Anderson, Senior General Manager of the Streets at South Point, says, "It's hard to predict the future, but curbside has increased value, and customers are accustomed to using it now." When South Point reopened May 12, traffic began trickling in at about 25% of pre-COVID numbers. Now the shopping center is attracting over 50% of its pre-pandemic traffic counts. Initially, shoppers seem more inclined to spend time in the outdoor lifestyle area. Now, Anderson says, the traffic is as balanced between the interior and exterior settings as it was in summers past. The intent, Anderson notes, is to do whatever we can to help tenants get back to normal and to keep customers comfortable as they find their way back. Curbside reinforces both commerce and comfort levels. Currently, there are 31 South Point tenants participating in curbside service. That continues the evolution in shopping, one that accelerated with the surge in online shopping. Online retail sales will be up well over 50% in 1 year, if not up double, Green says. In the first quarter, about 12% of all retail transactions were over the internet. I wouldn't be surprised to see that go to 20-25% by the end of the year. Consumer reluctance to return to in-store shopping isn't all about fear. It's also about change behaviors, and convenience and affordability play a role as well. As Mettner highlights, developing omnichannel excellence requires rethinking the physical space as well as the online offering. Larger formats will need to go smaller, and the number of locations will need to streamline. This reduction in the number of locations will be a challenge for landlords, he notes. And it begs the question, where's the next generation of tenants coming from? There was a nice boost 10 to 15 years ago with all the cell phone companies opening retail stores. I think we will see a new era of tenants who are responding to the millennials and the new generations who are looking for different things. It's going to be very difficult for retailers who are not offering an experience to maintain the same footprint. Anchors away. Department stores, which were already skating on the edge of extinction, have the greatest need to downsize their footprints and rethink their models. The reason department stores are such large sizes is to accommodate all of that product. Why have a store that's 150,000 square feet carrying 250,000 SKUs, stock keeping units, and trying to stay in stock of every color and size of every item? It's just crazy, Meitner says. Instead, the department stores could take another chapter from Amazon and become showrooms, places to browse products that can be ordered and fulfilled from a central warehouse to home delivery. That's the kind of reinvention Meitner envisions. Instead of department stores carrying millions of dollars of inventory they don't really need, they can centralize the inventory and become much more efficient. And if consumers want to order online and pick up at the store, they could do that as well. Niffin cites Nordstrom as a good example of a department store that gets it. Nordstrom was an early adopter of omnichannel. They still have big stores, but they'll have fewer big stores going forward. They've built these 1,500-square-foot satellite stores that are all about personal services. Indeed, the brand the economy introduced in 2019, Nordstrom Local, is made up of small stores that carry no inventory but facilitate pickups, returns, and a host of services through intimate neighborhood shops. There are two locations in New York City and three in Los Angeles. But even retailers that embrace reinvention are facing some dark days ahead. Niffin asserts, "We know that Nordstrom is going to close 19 stores minimum. There will be fewer Neiman Marcus stores, probably fewer Saks stores, and there probably are not going to be any Lord & Taylor stores when COVID is over. Macy's has already said they're going to close 125 stores, but I think Macy's will close 200. JCPenney has said it will close a bunch of stores, but I think they have close to at least 350 of their 850 stores to close. I don't think there will be any Sears or Kmart stores left when this is over, and I think there will be fewer Stage stores, Boscoff stores, and Stein Mart stores, and that's just going through the department store space." In his estimation, 20% of the national stores inside malls will close. Local mom-and-pop stores will close as well, but as he explains, that happens every year, and every year new mom-and-pops emerge. However, there will be more attrition of local and regional stores in 2020 than in years past. Still, Meitner cautions against writing off the shopping center industry and points to how quickly shoppers have returned to retail in the United Kingdom. They just opened up in the UK, and people are shopping like crazy, as if they just rediscovered shopping as a new form of entertainment. So the pronouncements about the death of retail, that shopping malls will just become dust bowls, it's too easy to predict those broad sweeping assumptions, he says. Future moves. Looking ahead, the hotter topic within commercial real estate, Kayyem says, is how to value shopping centers and stores in a new environment. In its 2019 annual report, Brookfield Properties, owner of South Point, said average sales per square foot at its core retail properties was $798. Sales per square foot used to be the end-all, be-all metric, and now that's completely changed, Kayyem says. With the omnichannel model, stores are being used as showrooms, stores are being used for fulfillment, and stores are used in a variety of ways to connect with the consumer. Malls and retailers alike have to create a point of differentiation, something that entices the consumer to visit and to shop. As Niffin recounts, years ago, malls were built with food courts because developers thought consumers would want some downtime while they were shopping. Then they started building malls with great restaurants so people would come to eat and shop. Experiential retailing is not dead. It's had a huge setback because of COVID, but this trend to more restaurants and more things to do in the mall is going to continue, he says. And the malls that do it well, even if they aren't in that top 278, will in fact be the survivors. The best path to reinvention may be waiting to be defined, and in Meitner's view, quite possibly involves augmented reality or a tech-enabled experience. It took a tech company to teach retailers a new way of retailing, he says. When Apple came out with stores, they reimagined retail in a way that I wasn't capable of doing, and I'd been in retailing for decades. Sometimes merging with people who are not encumbered with all of your experience and prejudices is a way of breaking through to new opportunity. If I were a shopping center today, I would certainly be thinking about that. And there's also a short related article with this cover story. REITs see drop in value in pandemic. Retail REITs, real estate investment trusts, have seen shareholder values plummet and cash flow disappear as tenants were unable to pay rent. In the history of retailing, we've never seen a time when so many national retailers had their cash flow essentially go to zero. Even in a recession, cash flow goes down by 10% or maybe 15%. It's never gone down by 100%, says Jan Niffen, retail industry analyst. REITs and retailers are all under pressure. Everyone wants to pay rent, stay open, and stay in business, but it will depend on how fast they can reopen and get their cash flow going again so they can pay rents. There's a short list of REITs that industry analysts concur will not only survive but may actually emerge stronger post-COVID. Brookfield Properties, based in Chicago and owner of Streets at South Point, is on this short list. Indianapolis-based Simon Property Group, one of the largest REITs in the country, tops the list. And Taubman Centers in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, which has some of the highest performing properties in the country, with average sales per square foot of $955 as of March 31, is also among the top three. Simon was set to acquire Taubman, but backed out of the deal when COVID struck. On the other side of the spectrum, many REITs that once prospered are failing. Jeff Green, partner in the Hoffman Strategy Group, notes that some REITs have indicated to Wall Street they are concerned about their ability to survive. Philadelphia-based PREIT, P-R-E-I-T, which owns more than 22.5 million square feet of retail space, and CBL Properties, based in Chattanooga, Tennessee, are among these. While PREIT does not have properties in North Carolina, CBL owns some of the largest malls in the state, including Cary Town Center and Haines Mall in Winston-Salem. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the biz page, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Murals may find a new home. Dozens of businesses across downtown Raleigh remain boarded up this week, including even the studios of ABC 11 and multiple other high-profile storefronts. But there's some color and beauty in the scene as well, as some of the plywood boards have been decorated with highly colorful murals. And some of those may be headed toward a new home eventually as a way to remember and reflect on the events of recent weeks. Sarah Powers, the executive director of the Office of Raleigh Arts, says several sites, including Dorothea Dix Park, are being considered as the hosting place as it looks at continued programming around the art created in response to the Black Lives Matter protests. The Raleigh Murals Project and Black on Black Project have curated about 20 works that are directly related to the movement, and there are also many other artworks that popped up organically, Powers tells Biz. My office is working on documenting what's out there and will also help coordinate whatever is decided for the future of the artwork. The Raleigh Murals Project, which has been a driving force behind more public art in the city, says Royale Raleigh commissioned some of the original ones to spark interest in the idea. The concept has sparked some remarkable work, including a painting of Morgan Freeman at Apex Outfitter and Board Company. Tower rises on Hillsborough Street as Raleigh's skyline changes. A 19-story tower is rising on Raleigh's Hillsborough Street, a reminder that many projects that were already out of the ground will continue. The Fallon Company's 301 Hillsborough, the future home of Pendo, remains on schedule for delivery in the fourth quarter of 2021, says Fallon Managing Director Zach Von Cannon. The project is already 8 stories up, which includes the retail level, double-height lobby, and parking. The tower will include 280,000 square feet of office space and 12,000 square feet of retail. Obviously, the pandemic has impacted leases, but Von Cannon says the longer time frame could help. Since we don't deliver for 16 to 18 months, people have been reaching out to us, he says. Von Cannon adds, Raleigh is historically a market where people like to touch and feel. They like to see a building built before they commit. Fallon plans 2 more towers at the site, one a hotel and the other residential, but Von Cannon says the firm is weighing options. Right now, we are using this as a chance to take a step back, he says. Do we still have conviction with our original design? Do we want to change anything? Hot idea in road design coming to I-40 interchange. If you think a diverging diamond has something to do with an engagement gone bad, you're behind the times when it comes to road construction. A diverging diamond intersection, or DDI, is a novel way of building roads, and the interchange at I-40 and Airport Boulevard will be converted into just that. The idea eliminates left-hand turns into oncoming traffic and is designed to reduce accidents and cut costs. It sounds like something some freshman engineers cooked up over beer pong, but the idea dates to the 1970s in France and was perfected by a graduate student at the University of Maryland more than a decade ago. The first American DDI was in Kansas City, Missouri in 2008. The intersections improve traffic flow and are cheaper to build, sparking a rising interest in the design. And if you want to try it out for yourself, you can, starting in 2023. RDU still looking to launch a China flight? The dramatic uncertainty in the world has crippled airlines and forced airports such as Raleigh-Durham International Airport to cut expansion plans. But Michael Landguth, the CEO of the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority, still seeks an airstrip that's 11,500 feet, which could handle a China flight someday. The expanded strip would also accommodate a planned expansion of Terminal 2. Eventually, it could be home to a direct flight to China, but Landguth says there is nothing imminent. At this point in time, we're just trying to figure out what a COVID-19 recovery looks like, he says. Greenville pizza business headed to Joco Food Hall. The owners behind a Greenville pizza place are bringing a new location to a food hall underway in Selma. Recently, the developers behind Eastfield Crossing and the Old North State Food Hall announced the hall's latest vendor, Luna Pizza Cafe. Restaurant owners Richard Williams and John Jefferson launched Luna in downtown Greenville in 2018. Both Williams and Jefferson trained in Florence, Italy. We're excited to be a part of Old North State Food Hall and look forward to bringing our Neapolitan pizza, exciting appetizers, and terrific desserts to both the local market and traveler, the pair said in a statement. And finally, what great CEOs learn to manage most, themselves. Research by a pair of senior partners at McKinsey shows some interesting insight into what makes a great CEO and is especially relevant in an era of long Zoom calls and distractions. Carolyn DeWar and Scott Keller examined 7,800 CEOs and found six traits of exceptional leaders. One interesting trait, beyond elevating teams and effectively working with boards, is that the best leaders know how to manage themselves. Amazon's Jeff Bezos, for example, schedules his most important meetings for 10 a.m. when he feels he is at his best and does not allow slide presentations. Good CEOs, our research found, stay organized and efficient, Keller says. For great ones, it's more about focusing their time on what only they can do. That means having a staff that doesn't just help manage their time, but also manages their energy. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Caleb Harshberger. Maryland developer seeks another Raleigh tower. A Baltimore developer is moving ahead with plans for the latest stage of its burgeoning downtown Raleigh development, calling for a new mixed-use office tower in the heart of downtown. Heritage Properties plans for the latest phase of Block 83 after filing a rezoning request with the city to allow for the development of a new 18-story mixed-use office tower. Plans filed with the city call for ground floor retail, parking, and office space. The project would be situated on a pair of properties at 615 West Morgan Street and 117 South Boylan Avenue, owned by Crocker Family Properties, LLC, and Betty Poole Brinkley, respectively. The Crocker family has owned the land on Morgan Street since 1966, according to county records, and currently the property hosts a pair of single-story retail properties at the corner of West Boylan Street and South Boylan Avenue. Brinkley took ownership of the property at 117 South Boylan Avenue in 1996 from James Poole at no charge, according to county records. The Poole family had owned the property since 1951. It's currently vacant. The properties are currently zoned for just seven stories and mixed use and sit adjacent to existing Block 83 properties. Across the street, construction has been underway for months on Tower 2, the $108 million sister tower to One Glenwood. Washington developer plans major project for downtown Durham. Plans would include up to 345 apartments, large retail component. Plans to bring a major mixed-use development to Durham include hundreds of apartments over retail and entertainment space. Developer Four Points of Washington, D.C. has filed plans for Gear House, featuring two buildings rising 9 and 18 stories on the northern end of town. The project calls for more than 500,000 square feet of space, including up to 345 apartments, more than 19,000 square feet of retail space, and 24,793 square feet of accessory and bridge space. The project is situated on 2.3 acres at 620 Foster Street on five parcels currently home to a collection of industrial and retail buildings. The Gear Street Garden property does not appear to be included in the plans. The buildings would sit on sloped ground and be connected by a bridge that sits above an open-air staircase. Uses for the non-residential space include retail, restaurant, bar, and nightclub. Phase one of the project features nine stories of mixed-use space, including four floors of parking mixed with retail and amenity space, and five floors of apartments. Altogether, the building will feature 205 apartments, 13,146 square feet of retail, and 14,555 square feet of accessory space. Florida investor buys property next to Duke campus. In a rare commercial real estate deal amid the pandemic, a Florida real estate investor has expanded its footprint in Durham with the purchase of a retail property. Ram Realty Advisors of Palm Beach Gardens closed recently on the Bull City market for $13 million. The retail center is near the edge of the Duke East campus and includes Whole Foods as an anchor tenant. The property is situated on 2.5 acres at 621 Broad Street off West Main Street and is by a collection of other retail properties near the campus. The seller, Houston-based Weingarten Realty, bought the property for $7.6 million in 2005. Bull City Market was built in 1996, according to county records, and features over 40,000 square feet of retail space. Raleigh developer plots new townhomes. A local developer is adding to its presence in Durham with a nearly 100-home development. Raleigh-based Level 5 Ventures plans to start construction this year on the Laurel Meadow Towns, a 97-home workforce housing development north of the city. The project is situated on 12 acres at 1107 Chalk Level Road, down the road from Whippoorwill Park, and less than 2 miles from Duke Regional Hospital. It's 97 townhomes, and it's in a great location, says Keith Greenwood, Level 5 Ventures founder. Durham is good to work with and is a great market to be in. Each townhome will feature three bedrooms and a garage. Pricing has yet to be determined, but Greenwood said the new homes will be priced at more affordable workforce rates. Keith Corp eyes big build to suit RTP project. A Charlotte developer is looking to add millions of square feet of new commercial space to Research Triangle Park. The Keith Corporation is moving forward with plans to bring up to 5.5 million square feet of build-to-suit commercial space across 104 acres in RTP after receiving site plan approval earlier this year. The project is situated at 3029 East Cornwallis Road, west of the on-ramp to the Durham Freeway, and across Cornwallis Road from Cree's Wolfspeed site. Buildings can range from 1 to 6 stories and feature a single large tenant or a collection of small to mid-sized tenants. Potential users include everything from lab and life sciences space to office and industrial. The company paid $7.6 million to GlaxoSmithKline for the property in 2018, and earlier this year, it brought on JLL to seek interested tenants. This project meets a need and a void for build-to-suit opportunities for life sciences and flex R&D office users that want to be in the world-famous Research Triangle Park, says Dennis Hurley, managing director with JLL. We're seeing a big demand for life sciences tenants. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. NC picks vendors to help test for and trace COVID-19. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, or NCDHHS, has chosen 26 businesses to form an initial pool of vendors to support the state's coronavirus response, especially in the areas of contact tracing and testing. The move is part of a strategy to lean on private businesses to build an infrastructure for responding to the pandemic. Given how the contagious and potentially dangerous this virus is for some, it is essential that we can surge resources where they are needed most, says Dr. Mandy Cohen, the DHHS secretary. We now have vendors at the ready that the state can put on the ground in local hotspots to support our communities. The move includes a wide variety of firms, including LabCorp of Burlington. According to NCDHHS, the selected companies are pre-qualified to work with the department. It says the first areas of work will focus on testing all residents and staff of nursing homes, as well as increasing testing for at-risk communities. Historically, marginalized populations are being disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 due to longstanding health inequities that NCDHHS is addressing proactively as it responds to this pandemic, the department says. It is also prioritizing minority-owned businesses as its selected vendors. According to NCDHHS, of the 26 companies selected, 14 are owned by minorities. NCDHHS has said additional vendors will be able to submit a response to its request for qualifications by the first of every month through December. It also said it plans to issue further RFQs for other functions beyond testing and tracing. The state selected 7 firms for testing and laboratory reserve capacity and 20 firms as vendors for contact tracing. C.W. Williams Community Healthcare Center of Charlotte was in both lists. Duke study, why your next job is likely to find you first. Research from Duke University could flip the idea of job hunting on its head. Duke's Fuqua School of Business has released results from research into the digitization of the labor market. Duke professors Enos Black and Sharik Hassan polled more than 13,000 workers across the U.S. regarding hiring and workforce trends. What they found was that more than half of the hires in the U.S. prior to COVID-19 resulted from a company's direct investment into employing recruiters or soliciting referrals to find candidates. The poll found 35% of those surveyed were referred to their job by an existing employee, and 18% said they were invited to apply to the job by a headhunter. Just 44% found their current job by applying for a position unsolicited. What this means is firms are hunting for talent, and finding the right candidate is being firm-driven as opposed to application-driven, Black says. According to a published paper on the research, which also included data analyzing millions of job postings from 2012 to 2018, the trends vary greatly depending on a number of factors. For example, the study found that company-driven searches are more prevalent for higher-income workers, of which 20% found their current positions through headhunters. And some numbers along with this article, 35% number of those surveyed who were referred to their job by an existing employee, 18% number who said they were invited to apply by a headhunter, and 44% found their current job by applying unsolicited. G1 Therapeutics inks Asian deal for cancer drug. G1 Therapeutics of Research Triangle Park has inked a deal with a Chinese company for the development and commercialization of its cancer treatment. The company disclosed a new deal with Shanghai-based Genor Biopharma, that's spelled G-E-N-O-R, for the exclusive development and commercialization of G1's drug, lerociclib, that's spelled L-E-R-O-C-I-C-L-I-B, in the Asian Pacific region, excluding Japan. It's an oral treatment designed to enable more effective combination treatment strategies and will add to Gaynor's portfolio of 8 clinical oncology compounds it is currently developing. According to the terms of the deal, reported by G1 to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the company will receive an upfront payment of $6 million in cash and is entitled to up to $40 million more based on development and commercialization milestones. In addition, once commercialized, G1 will receive tiered royalties ranging from high single to low double digits based on annual sales of the drug. UNC lands millions to combat teen vaping. Researchers at UNC Chapel Hill will lead a national effort to help discourage youth from using e-cigarette devices. The National Institute on Drug Abuse has tapped Professor Seth Noir from the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center to lead a 5-year study. Noir is also a professor at the school's Hussman School of Journalism and Media. The funding is $3.35 million, According to NOAR, the study hopes to identify the most promising messaging techniques to prevent the use of e-cigarettes. Those messages will then be evaluated in a randomized trial to determine whether daily text messages using the messages leads to a reduction in use of e-cigarettes. And finally, we have a quote. Eckert sees potential in Raleigh company fighting Alzheimer's. This is from Sprouts Pharmaceutical CEO Cindy Eckert on why she was interested in investing in Raleigh-based U-Method, which just launched its treatment for Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is a women's health crisis. Two-thirds of the diagnoses are women, and there's not a single medication today that alters the progression of the disease. When I was introduced to U-Method, I saw the possibility of evidence-based individualized treatment plans with real results, not only for patients with cognitive decline, but those at risk. And as we turn to the On Business page, we have two pages. First one is an article written by Connie Gentry. Raleigh Convention Center readies for comeback in years ahead. Revenue losses for the Raleigh Convention Center and the city are mounting daily as the convention and events industry was one of the first to shut down due to the pandemic and likely will be the last to open. We've lost $80.8 million in direct impact and are down 189,000 attendees at our last count, says Carrie Painter, director and general manager of the Raleigh Convention Center and Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts. The earliest reopening will be in the fall, and the complex likely would open in modified stages with events that can be supported by lower attendance. As Painter explains, events such as concerts and conventions require large crowds of people. For a concert to make money, it requires a great capacity of audience, where the symphony has some performances like a chamber group that could be successful having 300 to 500 people in a 2,200-seat theater, she says. It becomes complicated and even more competitive because associations and conference groups are often booked years in advance. A conference scheduled for Raleigh this year might have been moved to 2024, Painter says, simply because that's the next year in the rotation being planned. We were really riding high, she says. What is a bit of a silver lining, Raleigh is still Raleigh, and COVID has happened to the world, not just us. It isn't going to change the perception of our location. We were gratefully busy, and many conferences had grown beyond the capacity of our building or the hotels in our city. Before the pandemic, the city had been planning to expand the convention center with a hotel and mixed-use project downtown. Now, those discussions have slipped to the back burner. But that doesn't mean the convention center is sitting idle. RCC is pursuing accreditation from the Global BioRisk Advisory Council, or GBAC, to earn the GBAC Star, which is a cleaning industry's only outbreak prevention, response, and recovery accreditation program for public and commercial facilities. We're looking at certification for the entire complex, which would include Red Hat Amphitheater, Duke Energy Performing Arts, and the Convention Center, Painter says. The application process and accreditation cost approximately $4,000, which covers the three downtown venues. RCC joins a host of other major venues across the country that are seeking the certification. It expects to learn by late summer or early fall if the complex has met the requirements and received the certification. And now we turn to David Pertell's On Business page. Health issues paramount as businesses recover. The health and safety of employees and clients, as well as an increased risk of liability, are the biggest concerns among Triangle business leaders as they prepare to reopen their offices. The Business Journal surveyed leaders in the region and across the United States to see how the nation should get back to business. Results show 92% of 144 Triangle respondents are at least somewhat concerned with managing the health and safety of employees. 38% were extremely concerned. Nationally, 41% of respondents are extremely concerned about health and safety. The sentiment is similar when it comes to managing the health and safety of clients, with 58% of Triangle respondents saying they're very or extremely concerned. That's compared to 60% nationally. Nearly 50% of Triangle business leaders said they're very or extremely concerned about having customers and clients come back, compared with 33% who are somewhat concerned and 18% who have no concerns. When it comes to increased potential for liability, 85% are at least somewhat concerned, while 15% said they have no concerns. Nationally, 45% were at least very concerned. As for finding and retaining employees, nearly 50% of local leaders aren't concerned, while 10% are extremely concerned. At the time of the survey, 60% of Triangle respondents said their employees were working from home exclusively. MCNC names state official as next CEO. MCNC, a nonprofit pushing for broadband connectivity in North Carolina, has chosen a state official as its president and CEO. Tracy Doakes, currently secretary of the North Carolina Department of Information Technology, will replace Jean Davis, who last year announced her plans to step down after 6 years at the helm. Doakes starts in August. She has been with NCDIT since 2015 and took over as secretary earlier this year. As secretary, she is in charge of the state's IT procurement, cybersecurity, operational services, broadband infrastructure, and more. Before joining NCDIT, Doakes worked for Duke Health, as well as the State Department of Revenue and Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. Doakes said, "I have had the privilege to work with a talented and dedicated team at NCDIT. As a member of the MCNC Advisory Council, I know the great work this organization does, and I am excited to join this team." And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page, where the Triangle Business Journal welcomes letters to the editor. First, we'll read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. Economy's next big problem? Managing bad loans. For the most part, the U.S. economy has been in emergency mode for the past 3 months, with the government printing money to keep the wheels turning. The pandemic unleashed a series of debilitating blows that clearly has crippled the economy and forced billions of people across the world to adjust their behavior when it comes to working, shopping, playing, dining, pretty much every facet of their lives. Those adjustments made by consumers are about to hit the U.S. economy in a big way, one that eventually will determine the winners and losers across all industries as employers adjust how they sell products and services. What will come under the microscope in the next 2 quarters are the performance and risk assessment of the financial services industry. Credit ratings giant Fitch put out a report June 23, warning that the agency is bracing for asset quality deterioration and rising defaults in commercial real estate, CRE loans, with the biggest downside risk for smaller and regional banks that relied on CRE to pad their portfolios. CRE, in totality, is a lot smaller of a business, percentage-wise, for bigger banks than the community and regional banks, says Christopher Wolf, managing director of North American Banks for the New York-based ratings agency. Between 2005 and 2008, banks got hurt because of weak underwriting processes. However, this time, it looks quite different. Fitch estimates since the Great Recession in 2008, banks with $10 billion to $100 billion in assets have expanded CRE lending amid a relative pullback by larger peers. And numbers reflect that conclusion. Larger banks, on average, have about 50% of their regulatory capital committed to CRE. It is a 165% of capital for banks with assets of $10 billion to $100 billion, and 184% of capital for banks with assets less than $10 billion. Because CRE loans are secured, the elevated loan defaults may not reflect a spike in a bank's loss provisions yet. As it is, with a forceful nudge from federal and state governments, banks have been offering payment deferrals or interest-only payments to a lot of their customers that could last through the end of the year. "We really don't know what the consequences would be long-term," Wolf opines when talking about the eventual effect of additional liquidity through various programs from the Federal Reserve and the passage of the CARES Act. "We haven't seen this movie before, but it already looks like banks have dialed in their risk appetite for CRE loans." Without question, banks themselves are in a much stronger position than they were in during 2008, when they were part of the problem that almost brought down the $20 trillion economy. This time, however, banks could play a role in solving the impending crisis. Already, thousands of community, regional, and large financial institutions have played a pivotal role in moving money to small businesses through the U.S. Small Business Administration's Paycheck Protection Program. That resulted in millions of additional workers staying off the bursting-at-the-seams unemployment lines across the country. The bank's next challenge would be how to manage loan portfolios. If financial institutions start calling on CRE loans for fear of a worsening economy, then office, retail, and industrial projects all across the country may come to a halt, thereby paralyzing our economic rebound. Inevitably, some CRE loans will collapse in the coming quarters, but most of them will likely need some form of assistance to get back on firmer ground. The big question, how long can lenders remain patient? We may soon find out as banks prepare to deliver their yearly guidance when announcing their second quarter earnings. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a guest column written by Chris Budnick, who is the executive director at Healing Transitions, a nonprofit organization that provides free life-saving recovery services to more than 300 homeless, uninsured, and underserved individuals in Wake County every day. The headline, Looking for the Good During Trying Times. The realities of the COVID-19 pandemic are forcing all of us to navigate between two deadly diseases, COVID-19 and addiction. On one hand, we must mitigate the spread of this virus, but at the same time, people are losing their battle to addiction every day. Last month, under the guidance of the Wake County Public Health Branch of the Emergency Operations Center, Healing Transitions made the incredibly difficult decision to stop accepting new participants at either of our campuses. These recommendations were based on the critical need to prevent the risk of introducing COVID-19 to our overcrowded campuses. Though this situation is unprecedented in our history and we've had to stop accepting new participants, we remain committed to our mission. As we navigate the uncertainties of COVID-19 and the challenges that we've faced as a result, we're inspired by the resiliency and strength of our village in the addiction recovery community in Wake County. The word gratitude barely begins to describe our appreciation for our partners, nonprofit and for-profit organizations, city, county, and statewide government leaders, first responders, and healthcare workers on the front lines working overtime to ensure our most vulnerable neighbors remain fed, clothed, housed, and safe. You are heroes in our book, and you've kept us pressing on. That's why we've worked around the clock with Wake County, the Department of Health and Human Services, Alliance Health, Southeastern Healthcare, WakeMed, and UNC Health to open an off-site detox facility to serve the individuals we're turning away. Because without immediate, low-barrier access to services, individuals may never make it back to our doorstep. This is why recovery can't wait. Just like all of our nonprofit colleagues, we're filled with uncertainty. Planning for the future is exceedingly difficult with new protocols, while new protocols evolve every day. We're scared donations might slow down, and we feel the weight of losing our vital volunteer workforce. Our community needs the nonprofit sector now more than ever. Please do what you can. Send an encouraging note to our staff, our leadership, or our participants. Share our social content, or take some time to reflect on how you'll plug into our mission once things settle down. Finally, please don't forget the tremendous amount of good happening every day. What we've observed from our larger community for years gives us great confidence that we'll all come out of this current crisis having discovered new strengths and relationships forged through shared hardship. Be encouraged as you look for the good in your own communities and witness how powerful we are when we come together one day at a time. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Executive Voice Question and Answer column that focuses on Devin Williams. The headline, Young Lawyer Taking the Lead at Warden Smith, and this is written by Dane Huffman. Devin Williams has a thirst for competition. She played collegiate softball at the University of Maryland and has completed 6 half Ironman triathlons. Williams, 33, has also excelled as an employment lawyer and will become co-managing partner at Warden Smith at the end of the year. The firm has 89 attorneys across 5 offices, and Williams' rise to leadership at a time of tremendous transition in business and law. She is also pregnant with her first child, meaning the years ahead will be ones of change and challenge. Growing up in North Carolina, why did you pick the University of Maryland? I saw it as an opportunity to try something completely different and new. I knew no one going into Maryland, but that was exciting to me because it gave me the opportunity to truly find out if I could make it on my own. What did you learn as a college softball player? I had to learn effective time management skills to prioritize academics and balance my responsibilities as an athlete. In addition, it developed my teamwork mentality, enhanced my commitment to always keeping a positive attitude, and forced me to cultivate my mental toughness. I use all of these skills on a daily basis as a lawyer and a leader. What drew you to the law? My second grade class took a field trip to the Rowan County Courthouse, where we performed a mock trial. I was the prosecutor and loved it. I went home that day and told my parents that I wanted to be a lawyer. Ultimately, my decision to become an attorney boils down to the honest yet cliche reason that I want to help people, and I like a challenge and good competition. What cases did you find the most rewarding? I tend to enjoy anything that challenges me or stretches my knowledge and skill base. I like an uphill battle when the odds are stacked against me. I don't like it for the client, but I like it for myself to see if I can pull off the impossible. Given my practice in labor and employment law, I am constantly dealing with people issues. Due to that, no one employment issue is the same, even if it involves a similar legal issue. This forces me to evaluate and strategize based on not just the facts and the law, but also the human side of each case. Helping employers in those kinds of situations is fulfilling. What plans do you have? What key plans do you have? I plan to focus on issues related to driving technology for efficiency, recruiting the next generation of talented attorneys, and continuing to uphold our cherished teamwork culture. We don't pay our attorneys in the same way as most firms, and that really impacts culture. We don't track or originations here, and that allows for a level of teamwork not frequently seen at other places. How will you manage more experienced attorneys? I've always known it's essential to earn my teammates' respect and trust before I can be an effective leader. I hope that my selection into this role by my peers indicates that I have earned their respect and trust, at least in part. However, I do not take that for granted, and I will continue to focus on earning and keeping the respect, trust, and confidence of my partners. I also try to lead by example, communicate in a transparent and respectful manner, keep an open mind and an open door. While I'm sure there will be hiccups, disagreements, and tough calls, I will do everything I can to demonstrate to my peers that I am a fair, fierce, devoted, and effective leader who has their best interests and the firm's best interests at heart. With the pandemic, what issues will attorneys face? From an employment law perspective, I think we will see a rise in claims alleging a variety of wrongdoings and statutory violations committed by employers, including an increase in discrimination charges, wrongful termination claims, failure to accommodate, wage and hour violations, OSHA violations, workers' compensation cases, etc. The list is nearly endless. Employers have had to make very difficult decisions during this time, all while balancing existing legal requirements on top of the rapidly evolving societal landscape, with new legislation and interpretive guidance being issued on an almost weekly basis. Will the pandemic have a long-term impact on law firms? COVID-19 is likely to lead to an increased reliance on technology and remote working environments across the legal industry and many others. Out of convenience and to keep costs down, I think we will see an uptick in virtual mediations, depositions, and hearings. For employers, what key advice are you giving them now? With COVID-19, guidance is coming out at an incredible rate, so you do need to talk with your employment attorney before you make employment decisions. Expert guidance is needed right now. There aren't one-size-fits-all solutions with COVID. Why did you decide to settle in Cary? My husband jokes that settling in Cary was the first 50-50 compromise in our marriage. I drive 10 minutes to work, and he drives 45. I married well. What's a food you love to eat? Right now, as a pregnant person, there are lots of foods I love eating, but the one that I miss the most during this time is sushi. I could eat sushi every day and not get tired of it. Also, my friends know this about me. I love mayonnaise and all forms of spicy mayonnaise, especially on sushi. What's something you won't eat? I don't eat mustard, the antithesis of mayonnaise. It ruins a perfectly good sandwich. Is there a particular quote or saying that is meaningful to you? I love this quote from Maya Angelou. I've learned that people will forget what you said. People will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And with our remaining time with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll move to the small business section to read James Lee's column. James Lee is a family business speaker, advisor, and author. The headline, Planning in a Family Business is Worth All the Time and Trouble. It's a mantra of polite conversation. Now, don't go to a lot of trouble. Oh, I didn't mean to put you to a lot of trouble. It'll work out, so there's no need for a lot of trouble. Sincerely uttered or not, the don't go to a lot of trouble disclaimer gets tossed back and forth in picnic planning, carpool scheduling, and negotiating Aunt Maud's summer visit. It makes a certain social sense even when it's overruled. But the mantra takes on an ominous ring when a senior family business owner says, a succession plan? Hey, we all know what we want to do about the kids taking over the company, so why go to a lot of trouble? That's one of the worst judgments a family in business can make. When it comes to laying out the process of ownership and management succession, go ahead. Go to a lot of trouble. Go to the trouble of getting all the right people involved. Organizing meetings or even small group sit-downs can be a real hassle when family members and their commitments are all over the map. But it's worth the trouble to get communication flowing among those who are directly affected by the succession plan, along with spouses, siblings outside the business, and others with legitimate interests and influence. The whole crowd doesn't have to vote on the final decisions, but they should be aware of the process and of the reasons why certain choices are made. Also, don't forget to bring professional advisors on board early in the process of reviewing ownership transfer options. The attorney, financial and tax advisors, and perhaps a family business specialist can help with constructive advice and keep you from taking dead-end pathways. Being open and honest can be a lot of trouble, but it's important. If family involvement is to have any real value, it must be characterized by openness. Family business succession is about creating the future of the business and the family. Things such as career aspirations, financial needs and expectations, and roles and relationships inside and outside the business should be discussed without suspicion, negativity, or fear of criticism. It's a ticklish process, but it's important to get everyone's honest thoughts on the table so succession planning isn't undercut later by surprise or disappointment. And we'll stop there as the rest of the advice is to be businesslike and to write everything down as you're going through the process. And, you know, we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long, and until next time, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.